This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Right now is one of the most important times in the 26-year history of Joy. Times are tough financially, but that will never stop us delivering powerful, meaningful, and uplifting radio for you. To get ready for the future, we're launching Joy Nation, and we need your support to do it. So help Joy by asking your workmates, your next door neighbour, your mum, your dad, your siblings, and of course your friends. Go to joy.org.au and make a donation to build Joy Nation. Joy, your voice, your radio station.
Across Melbourne on Joy 94.9 and streaming online at joy.org.au, you're listening to Saturday Magazine, every Saturday 10 till 12.
And you're here on Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9 with Janet Jukes and Taz.
Thank you, Janice. Great.
I'm still learning how to do that reset, but we'll get there.
I'm going to ask you this. So you're Janet Jukes and I'm Taz. I love just having one name, by the way, but I do have a last name as well.
I know you do. But you never use it.
No, I don't because it's actually a P in the A. It's a real pain.
It's a pain.
Okay, let's move right along. Our next guest is the leader of the Victorian Greens Party, Samantha Ratnam. We have a commitment to have dialogue with all members of all political spectrums, and it's really good to have this level of engagement with the Victorian Greens. Good morning to you, Samantha.
Good morning, Tess, and good morning, Janet, and everyone listening.
Thank you for making time again this morning for us. We always love having conversations with you on air and your colleagues, and love hearing your side of the world and your view of politics and what's occurring. Samantha, we've got a number of topics we'd like to discuss with you. You've been in the media just recently talking about raising the age of criminal responsibility from the age of 10 to 14. You've also been talking about the Victorian government's wish to introduce a new tax or levy on electric vehicles. But before we talk about that and those issues, during the week you made some comments about the opposition's leadership spill. Could you tell us what you were saying and remind us what your points were there?
Look, it was you couldn't be in Parliament without being affected by what was happening with the Liberal Party still earlier this week. And what became clear to me was that this opposition is actually not fit for opposition and not fit for office. And you can see that through the behaviour we've seen recently. But what's really worrying about that is that if Victoria is moving towards a one-party state, because you actually need a diversity of voices in the parliament, particularly to hold governments to account, to be a check and balance on power, but also to be constructive and put big ideas on the table. Because we know, and I know from being inside the parliament, having those differences of views and different ideas on the table really makes for better outcomes. And it's really worrying when the opposition isn't up to the task. I'm really glad the Greens have been playing that role in parliament, but it's something that we really need to watch.
So how can you say that the opposition is not fit for opposition? I mean, give us some examples or your evidence around that.
Well, it seems to be that they are more interested in infighting. We've seen them in the news more about these leadership tensions and leadership spills, which really, I think, takes them away and distracts them from their job at hand. If they're vying to be the government, they should be putting the big ideas on the table. They should be leading by example, but we're seeing quite the opposite. Throughout the pandemic, they actually were really irresponsible with some of the things they were saying. They were fanning the flames of some of those misinformation campaigns, and we felt that inside the parliament very, very intensely. There were some really ferocious campaigns in the public, which members of parliament, members of opposition, were then giving them a platform inside the parliament to keep that misinformation going. And I think that was really irresponsible. That was really playing poker with our lives during an unprecedented time.
Can you give us some examples? I'm really interested in what you're saying, but I'd love to hear some examples.
Certainly. There was this really important piece of legislation called a state of emergency legislation that came up during the pandemic, and this was to give the Chief Health Officer the powers to be able to, implement a number of measures that would keep us safe, during those lockdowns and the periods of restriction. Now, nobody liked lockdowns, absolutely, but we needed to do a number of things to be able to control the pandemic. We had the opposition day after day basically going against the chief health officer's advice, basically kind of arming up the community, fanning flames of fear as well. Like, people were genuinely scared. And instead of calming those fears down through a unified approach and showing leadership, they were actually exploiting that division, exploiting that fear, making people feel more scared. And I think that was really irresponsible.
That's a really good example, actually, a really good example. And so the other point that you made in this conversation was that you're beginning to see yourself, the Greens Party, as being the credible opposition. Talk to us a bit more about that.
Well, we really want to play a constructive role in the Parliament, but at the same time, really hold the government to account. And as much as we, for example, backed the public health response that the government adopted to managing the pandemic, there were several areas where there was overreach. For example, police overreach. We weren't sure whether people had the right to protest. You had intense police presence at refugee protests and refugee rallies, you know, when protesters were demanding that people be released from these hotel rooms that they didn't feel safe even with COVID. So there were really genuine things to protest about, and you had the government not being able to provide enough clarity, you had the police overreaching, and those are the types of things that we really call on the government to rethink and relook at. And in the last couple of months, as we've renegotiated an extension to the state of emergency, we were able to get a number of gains, including young people not being fined thousands of dollars that they had been with no ability to pay because of what happened during COVID.
So one of the other topics, Samantha, that we've been that you've been talking about this week is a new bill to raise the age of criminal responsibility from 10 to 14. So I understand that this has been you know, a policy position that's been floating around for, well, decades really. And it's around trying to you know, recognise why children and young people are involved in criminal activity. Can you tell us a little bit about the bill and perhaps perhaps explain to us why are you doing this now?
So in Australia, children as young as 10 can be arrested, put through the court system and locked up in prison cells. And when you actually talk to people about that, a lot of people are surprised because they don't know that the age is that young. We've also got this policy or these laws disproportionately affecting First Nations, people from Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander backgrounds, make up the greatest number of children in our prisons and as young as 10, and that shouldn't be happening. So this is following international calls for raising the age of criminal responsibility, something that Australia has taken a while to come up to speed with, and we really think Victoria has a chance to lead the way and lower the age of criminal responsibility so that children get the care and protection and support they need, not be put through a prison system that we know has really devastating effects for the rest of their lives.
So tell us about some of the ideas that you have about how you might support children rather than sort of giving them a criminal offence, putting them in jail, how much you support some of these young children.
Actually, there's quite a system in place already that, you know, helps young people divert away from the court system. So that if you could strengthen that system, and that's counselling and supports and alternative activities, we've actually done a lot of work in that regard. It's just about changing the law to make sure that more children are moved away from the criminal justice system into the rehabilitation and support and care system. So we know what to do. We just need to change the law to be able to do it and make sure less kids end up locked up in prison cells. And I think the majority of the community agree that children should not be in prison cells, and it's no place for them.
So my understanding of the youth justice system is that children wouldn't normally be, you know, we don't, as a first port of call, lock up children, that there is a whole sliding scale, really, of responses to criminal activity in young people. And that includes community-based orders and case management by actually being incarcerated is really the very end of the of a very long process, rather than the first response. Is that your understanding too?
Yes, so while there are diversion programs, and some of those programs are working well, we still do end up with children in prison when it's a place that we know has really disastrous impacts for them. And you actually see the numbers of children in prison increasing in our northern states. And this is an issue of racial justice too, with Aboriginal people being the most incarcerated people on earth, where two-thirds of our children's prison population is First Nations children. You know that this is a problem of systemic discrimination. So if we're going to be really serious about ending racial injustice and fixing that systemic discrimination, because it's disproportionately affecting one part of the population, that's why you need a change in legislation, because clearly it's unfair and it's really having a devastating impact on our First Nations particularly.
Samantha, I'm going to change the topic if I can. Raise another issue during the week, and that was that you were fairly critical of the Victorian government for introducing a new tax on electric vehicle usage. Explain to us why you're concerned about that. I mean, as I understand it at the moment, each time you buy petrol at the Bowser, you buy some petrol for yourself, you buy some petrol for the state government and some petrol for the federal government. Mm-hmm. So it only seems fair to me that electric vehicles would also, you know, contribute towards the cost of our roads and infrastructure, and this is a way to actually get some revenue to do that. So what's your concern? Why were you opposed to that?
So firstly, in a time where we're in a climate emergency, we should actually be making it easier for people to drive electric vehicles, which are much better for the environment than petrol and fossil fuel powered vehicles. And what we've seen is the Victorian government really behind the eight ball when it comes to the uptake of electric vehicles. We've got one of the lowest uptakes anywhere in the world. It's a real shame that we're not incentivizing people to take up electric vehicles. So here we go, rather than instead of actually putting good incentives on the table, which would, for example, bring the cost down, because one of the biggest barriers is the cost of the vehicle for people, so we should be putting in place measures that could potentially bring down those costs for people so that people could buy it, you know, easily afford it as their car instead of buying a petrol-fueled car. So instead of those incentives, what they're doing instead is putting a penalty on someone who says, look, I want to do the right thing. I want to get a car that pollutes the environment less, and you're going to be slapped with a tax. And this seems to be really a fight between the state and federal government about revenue. So the fuel excise, for example, actually goes back into general revenue. So this is a bit of a, you know, revenue grab and pinch and fight between the state and the feds. And in the end, people are going to lose out. The environment's going to lose out, because we're just not doing enough to give people incentives to buy electric vehicles. And, you know, you just have to look at the rest of the world for really good examples of what we should be doing, not slapping a tax on people who want to do the right thing.
Look, that's a I can't disagree with what you're saying, Samantha. I think there have to be incentives to increase the take up of cars that aren't using fossil fuels. But at the same time, cars do need to contribute towards the cost of the infrastructure that they're using. And I would have thought that what we need is to put more pressure on the federal government to actually change the policy levers to make it more attractive for the whole nation to be investing in alternative vehicles that aren't using typical fossil fuels. So
it's true. The federal government absolutely needs to be doing
well. I think they've been asleep at the wheel on this one, to be quite honest with you.
Absolutely. But actually, electric vehicle drivers, with all the taxes they pay and the duty that they pay on their cars, you know, electric vehicles, for example, aren't within reach for many people because the starting price is so high. And that's because of layers of taxation which actually go into government. So they are paying their fair share. They're also trying to do the right thing and, you know, contribute to our environment, keeping greenhouse gases down. So we've got to really look at the big picture together. And some of these arguments are kind of Trojan horses for other things. Yes, the federal government isn't doing enough, but that's not an excuse for the state government to take five steps backwards when we should be actually putting incentives on the table to increase the uptake of electric vehicles.
Thank you very much for your time this morning, Samantha. We've run out of time, unfortunately. We will need to move on. But really good to have you on the airwaves and engaging with our community. It's much appreciated.
Oh, great to chat with you, and have a great day, everyone.
You too. Enjoy the rest of your day. It's going to be lovely.
Saturday Magazine, every Saturday from 10 until noon on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.